Good evening.
Good evening.
This is Module 13, Class 9, on June 16th, 2016, just for the record. And tonight we are working on Talk 6 of the text, which is called Identification with the Teachings. So this is the last talk in the book, The Complete Teachings of Mahayana, but there's one more class in this module, as we just commented, and it will be on Tonglen practice, and there are already written instructions you can download, and there'll be a class with meditation and guidance on it. So this last chapter in the text is called Identification with the Teachings. And what I have here with all the bullets on it is basically everything that is said, which we won't really get to. But the essential point here is that identification with the teachings means that the teachings are internalized. One simply has to manifest by one's being, bodhisattva activity, rather than feeling that you have a guidebook or set of instructions or some know-how or training that you can fall back on when you actually need it. This depends a lot on what we've done previously, and that includes an attitude of refuge in the Buddhist teachings, that is the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and an attitude of wanting to give up personal escape from samsara in order to help all sentient beings, which is known as the bodhisattva vow. It's not so much a matter of whether you have formally taken these or not taken them, but rather whether you actually have taken them to heart on your own. And these are actually prerequisites for understanding how to be the Dharma. This is beyond any intellectual speculation on the teachings, any attempt to figure out whether this is a good deal or not. Also, the spiritual friend and the teachings as they are taught are complementary. They are not in competition with each other. Another point made in the very first few paragraphs is that the bodhisattva path is working with aggression. That's quite a bunch of topics. Why is the bodhisattva path working with aggression? Or more specifically, how is it working with aggression? Why does it accomplish that? Is there some sense of that?
Well, aggression is speed, essentially.
Yeah.
It's getting you to slow down.
Slow down, and because you're working with others, one's own aggression and wanting to accomplish something starts to get very brutally exposed. Another point made here is that the teachings or the doctrine is a friendly message to be explored and to be understood, rather than, it says a menu here, or curriculum, I would say. So there's actually quite a bit in these first few paragraphs. But mainly it's about how to be, or or manifest the Dharma rather than to feel that you have been trained and therefore, one has been trained, but it's been internalized to the point where you don't need to refer to the to training at least.
Well, you do remember the training. I mean,
it's not forgotten. No, nothing's forgotten.
I think that's a little deceiving or deceptive in a way, because the training, because you know it so well, or you've studied it, and then you've thought about it and contemplated it. So then, when situations arise, the right action emerges on its own, almost because you've already worked with the meaning or the deeper meaning, and then I think the skillful means comes out of that, both your own meditation practice and the training, and you're able to take the right action or actually help in a way that's useful.
Yeah, there was this passage there that I thought was helpful for me, which just says, for that matter, you can't reject Hinayana and accept Mahayana at all. It's not like like Hinayana is the beginner's course, and then you graduate to Mahayana.
There used to be a slogan, or it wasn't even a T-shirt at seminary, that said, "Never forget the Hinayana," and that was really the important point. Yeah, exactly.
Also, we tend to like parts of the Dharma and not like other parts. And rather than just skipping them, one keeps coming back to them, perhaps disagreeing with them, going deeper until things start to make more sense than one first thinks.
I also like the phrase, the example. I prefer generosity rather than patience, so I'll have that, the idea.
Yeah.
All right, the menu.
That's the menu, right?
Yeah,
okay.
It's not the way it works.
No, not the way like that.
So, this is all nice, juicy stuff. Does anyone want to look at it a little more, or read it, or point out anything before we go on? This is basically the first six paragraphs, I think.
I thought it was amusing that you could be angry with the teaching because you hadn't thought of it first.
You could be angry at the teaching, but...
because you hadn't thought of it first.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah. I'm angry at the teaching because I wasn't smart enough to figure it out on my own. Yeah, that's a particular arrogance, isn't it?
Yeah, like when you hear the answer to a riddle, you feel you should have figured it out on your own.
Okay. I had to parse that to understand.
Yeah, that's being dark. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else people want to work on?
Very rare person, right? Yeah.
Well, I think you can also look at a teaching, and for me, I recognize when anger comes up, it's on top of fear. So if I can get underneath that to see the fear, what is that teaching that's making me afraid? And how can I be with that and accept that and open up to the teaching despite this? Let that be there, not try to cover it up or change it, but still move forward into being open to the teaching.
That's very good, yeah. In other words, there's always more and more depth to the teaching, more depth to be discovered as we find our resistance or our delight or our anxiety or our exuberance or however we react to it.
It's also when you can be with that, there's this amazing energy there to be able to kind of propel you forward into it and to go with it. So if for me, when I can let go of the story about why I don't like this, just let go of all the story and just be with that energy of what that is, that can actually kind of give me a little momentum to go into it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I would say, though, too, because you said that aggression for you underneath is fear. Mm-hmm. So I would caution you not to always look. You may not be that. That may not be true all the time. There may be something else under there sometimes. Mm-hmm. So if there's always a label on it,
yeah,
then
I'd say it's more flavor.
Okay,
as opposed to a label. It just feels, it's an uncomfortable feeling. And so whatever, and I've noticed that I don't like uncomfortable feelings.
No.
And that's my cue that I'm into something juicy here, and it's time to sit with this and just let it be there. And because I recognize whatever it is, fear or whatever, but I want to get away from it.
Right.
I want to get away from it. I want to change it. I want to bury it. There's all that, and usually that comes with words and a story, because my ego wants to kick in and justify why I want to get out of this uncomfortable feeling. So it may not be fear, mm-hmm. but I can tell that there is fear in dealing with it, feeling fear in being with it. There's some kind of, I don't want to be in that. So yeah. I'm trying to say, it's okay, I can be in this, and it's not going to kill me. In fact, if I just sit with it for a while, it might even turn into something kind of energetic.
Yeah. Well, and it's, there's always that undercutting ego.
Yeah.
And that, it's just like when you touch that raw nerve,
yeah,
it's very painful.
Yeah.
It's very painful. Go
over here. I love the word aggression because it brings to mind self-defense. And I'm tired of defending myself,
yes.
So I'd like to let that go. So I find that a very helpful suggestion.
Yeah.
We're even aggressive to ourselves, aren't we?
Probably most of all.
Yes.
Most
of all.
We have to civilize her, not everybody else.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Can I read this one little paragraph?
Yes.
Basically, we could summarize the teachings of the Bodhisattva path as being a way of transcending aggression, a way of working with aggression. When you begin to work with aggression, automatically commitment becomes part of your practice. Doctrinal studies do not bring out your aggression. They only talk about how to deal with it. But living your life brings aggression, speed, and leading your life automatically shows you how to relate with the complexities of your mental activities and emotions.
That's a really interesting paragraph.
Isn't it?
I like that. I think it was
there's so many parts to it.
Yeah, it's sort of what that sort of reminded me of is that it's not about the time you spend on the cushion.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah, and there was something I was reading, another book I was reading where they talked about the not to try too hard for meditative states, and they said that that's the equivalent of learning to kayak on a completely still ocean, mm-hmm. Which will enable you to kayak perfectly if there's no environmental conditions, but the moment there's one wave, you tip
right.
over.
It reminds me of when I was learning to row in a boat with eight people. We, in the winter, they go into these indoor situations, and the pool is like about as big as this room, and the boat's really long, and it goes nowhere. You're just practicing your, the form.
Yeah.
But it's exactly that situation. You could get really good at sitting there and then get out on that Merrimack River. And
it's like playing chess without an opponent.
Yeah.
And all you're doing is really moving pieces on the board. Well, when you have an opponent, you actually have to think through the dynamics.
Yeah.
That's playing chess without an opponent is not going to get you very far.
No.
You'll be very graceful moving your piece. That's about it.
Yeah. Well, that's a good Hinayana Mahayana description.
Mm-hmm.
working with people.
The text then goes on to deal with, first of all, three obstacles to identification with the teachings, and then the six paramitas, which we really have not touched on before since the whole time we've been here. And I hope we could spend a little time on the paramitas, because there's six juicy paragraphs on that. But First of all, the obstacles, and they are in the three paragraphs preceding the paramitas. I think you can find them pretty easily. A business-like mentality. What's the best way to accomplish this bodhisattva action? Is it efficient? And what am I going to get from this action? Will it work? Business-like mentality.
Guilty.
Now the next the next one, we've had a lot of experience in this class, and I don't know how many of you are here for that, but insult to personal dignity. These teachings are humiliating me. Now, we had this book by Dzongsa Khyentse Rinpoche. Who knows that?
Yeah.
So,
what
means
you
might want to
go.
Not a Buddhist.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
I'm not a Buddhist. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we got a lot of kickback. He's insulting me.
What's it called?
What makes you not
a Buddhist?
Oh, okay.
It's back in the summer on the module, whatever that was.
I'm actually rereading it right now.
Oh, good. Yeah.
He can be, he's a wild, funny person. And, it is insulting. It's not just him, but 2,000 years ago, someone realized what this problem was and is able to insult your ego. Really interesting.
Practice.
What did you say, Susan?
It's a lot of practice. 2,000 years, that's a long time to work on it.
Well, yeah, and we all go, we're all in the same boat.
Yeah. This is what I was referring to when I commented earlier. They say, I didn't know these things. Somebody else knew better than I did.
Yeah, that's it. Yep. Yep. Someone figured it out.
So I mean, if that's really your attitude about life, I mean, why look for wisdom anywhere else? Mm-hmm. That's how you step out, outside of yourself. Mm-hmm. Seems, incredibly narrow.
And the next one is, I went on the internet and I found some very good teaching this morning, so now I'm an expert and I can present it to you. One can very easily do that as a teacher, and we can do that to our spouses or our employees or employer or almost anyone we encounter. The Dharma can be used in some sense to impress people with how smart we are or how wise we are or how decent we are or whatever.
Actually a real danger.
What?
It's actually a real danger.
Yeah, it is. Very definitely.
Yeah, had the Dharma mansplained to me at social gatherings, it's not a pleasant experience.
Yeah, I'm sure I've done it plenty of times.
I'm not actually speaking about anybody in the room, but you know, if you feel a sense of guilt, go with that.
Generosity.
Oh my gosh,
too much.
Sorry.
I've actually had my husband tell me, thank you for not proselytizing. I was like, this is my trip, hon. You're welcome to come along if you want to. But he said he was very relieved that I found something that didn't require him to convert.
This is the first time. There been other times that
oh, no, no. It's just that he's seen other marriages fall apart when somebody found religion and wanted the rest of the family to go along. Mm-hmm. And I'm very clear about, my thing being my thing. And if they want to talk about it, that's great. I can talk their ear off, but it's not something I'm going to push on them. Because that would, and there's the other side of that. You push on someone, they're going to pull away.
Yeah.
But if you keep it to yourself and they see that you're really kind of changing and figuring things out and you're doing good by it, they kind of go, what's going on? Mm-hmm. What do you got?
Right. Do you think they could actually work with paramitas?
What are the paramitas?
Paramitas, and they are in six successive paragraphs here, actually. Generosity, okay, the paramitas are basically a tour through the skillful actions that a bodhisattva might need. And they have a traditional order, which doesn't mean that you always are going to discover it in that order. They are generosity, discipline, patience, energy, meditation, and knowledge, although you may find some people call it wisdom. It's called knowledge here. And I put in Sanskrit names not because we need them, but because if you're going to go on the internet, which you might want to do, and find out more about them, these names might help you to correlate it with someone using different terminology. These are Sanskrit names. So, I should say that when Emily and I got married, which was a Buddhist ceremony, it was organized along the theme of the six paramitas. And there were particular offerings, like those.
See, I never advanced very far. Especially on patience. Oh, sorry, Mike.
Yeah, that's okay. I can't recall all of them.
The things they give.
But they're six symbolic things on Shanai. And the ceremony master hands one of them to one of the two people getting married, who gives it to the other one, who puts it on the shrine, and then the next one goes in the other direction until the symbols for the six paramitas are put on the shrine. But we always see...
Is that part of your vow?
Yes, that is...
That you will work with those...
Okay. Yes, exactly.
That is the vow, yes.
Yeah, that is the vow.
It is the marriage vow.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. It's just one use of the paramitas, but they're a central core issue for the Mahayana teachings, and it's stressed in this chapter that they're good to understand, and we should be finding ways to work with them further.
Right.
Well, what's better than being in a marriage or other intimate situation with someone than to work on the paramita. Mm. I mean, that's when the stuff really starts coming up, right?
Maybe we should say what paramita actually means. I think that would be
good. Oh, that's a good idea. Well, it's a skillful activity.
Yeah.
See, it's the sort of the... What is the exact... Beyond.
So to go beyond.
Beyond, yeah.
So it's
the activity that takes you beyond.
It's transcendental activity.
Your ego.
Because properly practiced, it transcends self. Each one of them transcends self. Generosity beyond what am I going to get? Patient discipline beyond I'm going to follow the rule. Whatever. So that's why they are transcendental virtues or whatever they are.
I think they're a natural outcome of walking the Mahayana path and the Bodhisattva path. So it isn't like you decide, well, I'm going to be really generous now. It's that you're sort of on a molecular level shifting, so that in fact the sense of generosity becomes natural. That's how you manifest, because you're sort of you've already departed from your traditional position of holding on, of getting what's yours. So that's how these unfold, I think.
Does someone want to read generosity? We don't have to do it this way, but I thought it might be useful if we have we seem to have the time now to do this.
It starts with when you feel tired.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Just generosity?
Yeah.
When you feel tired, you fall asleep. You feel you need to rest. In the case of generosity, you feel you need to open more, so you get into it. You become generous. It's the same as the experience of hunger, which is an interesting comparison, I think.
Oh, that's because of the paragraph before he explains that.
Do we need the paragraph first?
Yeah, let's read that. Now then you can develop new compassion and paramita practices. Generosity, patience, discipline, and so forth. He doesn't want to enumerate them either. This also is a further personal involvement with the teachings rather than some particular trip you're being converted into. There is a sense that you are constantly being challenged by situations and you have to get yourself into them. It is rather like experiencing hunger or thirst. When you are hungry, you eat food. When you are thirsty, you drink water. You don't particularly have faith in the food or the water, but you experience a personal demand for them. Food can satisfy your hunger. Water will quench your thirst. So you create the food. You create the water. Nobody pushes you into eating and drinking. You feel a real need.
An unusual way of stating the feeling. Mm-hmm.
That actually made a tremendous amount of sense to me. That metaphor made explain that was a really good metaphor for why it's a natural outcome as opposed to just some layer of virtue imposed on your life.
That was a nicely put way to put that. Yeah.
It's also kind of organic. I mean, I've noticed some of the changes for myself. It's like I opened the door and a mosquito was coming in. And my initial reaction before would be, grab it, crush it. Instead, I kind of waved it out. And my oldest daughter was like, why are you doing that for a mosquito? And I'm like, I don't know. It just didn't feel right to crush it, or to kill it. It wasn't doing anything to me. It's just trying to get in the house. And it seems rather small, but I've noticed that more, which is just this desire to not cause harm, more getting stronger and stronger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if they can start with mosquito, that's pretty good.
Remember seminars where Rinpoche, outside where Rinpoche would be sitting, and he'd just be letting mosquitoes land on him and suck his blood and fly away, and we're all like, and he just, no problem. Still,
I don't know if I'm ready for that. Yeah. I don't know about that. But if it's not doing anything to me, I can't.
Well, sure, just,
you know.
Do we want to go through them?
Sure, yes.
Okay.
I can only think about flies, so. I found out, I don't know, over the past few years in my house, that if I walk somewhere from one end of the house to the other, you know, the flies seem to come along. Usually it's like one fly. And so I found out that if I walk to a door and I open the door, and they'll fly out because they weren't after me after all. They were after the draft. I think they were drafting and going out. So I was talking to my friend one day. He was on the other side of the screen. So I opened the door, and I'm in the screen, and he sort of said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm just letting fly out. And he thought it was crazy. In about 5 seconds, the fly came right along and flew in between us and waved goodbye. But it's not funny. You don't know what's going on.
It was the big black ones. They follow the light, I found. When I was going up to go to bed, and I'm turning off all the lights, now it's upstairs. I'm like, oh, wait, it's following the light. So I went downstairs, turned the light on by the door, turned off the light, and I waited like 2 minutes. Sure enough, I can hear him buzzing around the light up there.
Yeah.
So then I opened up the door, turned the outside light, turned that one on, and he went right out.
Oh, cool.
Well, we're into insects. Yeah. It's the time of year. Just fairly recently, a very large bumblebee came into my office, and I know he didn't want to be there, but we have a lot of azaleas out front, and I figured just, you know, open the door and it'll eventually smell or whatever the present person. Very well, so. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
So generosity.
So we have insects on our mind.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean being generous to those to whom, who will be grateful to us, for those who can pay us back or anything. And very often we just don't know. what the consequence of offering something is. It just goes out. We have no idea what we're doing.
And you can still get stung.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The discipline.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Muffy, you have that, right?
With discipline, you feel you need to put yourself in a situation in which you can work with the details of life rather than ignoring the whole thing frivolously. So you can get into discipline. It's the same as eating food when you are hungry.
Could you read that again?
With discipline, you want me to read the sentence?
No. Well, you started now with discipline.
With discipline, you feel you need to put yourself in a situation in which you can work with the details of life rather than ignoring the whole thing frivolously. So you can get into discipline. So you get into discipline. It's because you want to be in there.
That's right.
Yeah.
You need to. It's the same as eating food when you were hungry.
Yeah, ironically, discipline becomes rather easy when you want to do it. Not easy, but easier.
I just thought, this is funny, but I just had one more thought about the insects that we were talking about. So the first reaction often is that it's going to bother you, like either fly or more likely the mosquito or the bee. You were going to do something to it. Or maybe we're all getting this correct detachment because it's more like, well, the mosquito on the, well, the mosquito does want to bite you because it needs your blood, but certainly the bee is not interested in harming a person. They want to get to its flower or whatever. And so to see that rather than the first reaction being fear and wanting to protect myself, they don't care about you. If you just give it a way to get out, then.
Yeah, I mean, it's perspective, too. You're a gardener, I'm very pro bee, although I still have been stung a few times, because basically it's a really good sign of a healthy yard, a healthy environment to have the little insects in there.
Right.
So what is discipline?
Yeah. I think it's about vacuuming.
Vacuuming?
Go for it. I can't wait to hear this one.
When it comes to my house.
I don't know. That's what I thought of when this, thinking about discipline here. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of other discipline I have to do, but that's my lately.
What
I have to think of this week.
I do have a question about the word, because Sheila, I mean, isn't that, I thought of that as the word that's sort of for the general moral precepts in the, is that the same word?
Yes,
it is.
Yeah, that's sort of the basic sort of Hinayana or Theravada precepts.
Yeah.
There can be precepts, there's lots of ways to take it.
So it is the same word.
It is the same word.
Okay, just checking.
So what would make it transcendental? That's important to focus on when we do these. What is the transcendental aspect of discipline? Is the feeling I got to do this, so I better just do it?
Or it's like that there are the five precepts, and I'm, it's not just making sure I don't violate any of them. It's not just not violating the rules.
It's not that. Yeah. Right. It's I think the key here is always taking transcendence. So taking you beyond. So the point of the Mahayana is to travel to the other shore, and the other shore is liberation. So how do we actually achieve liberation or realize liberation? We actually can use these particular paramitas as a way to overcome our ego fixation and our ego clinging. So discipline can be a path that's laid out that we follow in terms of knowing it's a way to actually move along the bodhisattva path and move along the Buddhist path. So
structure.
Structure. So, for instance, meditation. So maybe you don't really feel like meditating every day. But then you realize, and it's good sometimes not to, and then you see what the difference is. And you go, well, things seem to be more light, and I'm more awake when I actually practice every day. So that discipline really carries me forward and carries me along the path. So I think understanding the point that these aren't rules that are imposed from the outside. I think that's what's interesting.
I think there's also the discipline of not falling into wasting, sort of being aware of when you're off the mark, and not letting yourself be frivolous in the sense of bringing your mind back when you find you're tripping out on something or being emotionally over the top. There's a discipline of bringing yourself back to sort of the same spot, the sort of, it's got you're aware, and you think of the discipline to not just let go, but to bring yourself back.
At the very end, there's a single sentence. Mahayana is all about waking up rather than being saved. That could probably be used for every single paramita. The discipline is, this is how what's needed to wake up beyond how I'm fixated.
Where is that?
The very last sentence, almost in the whole thing. Mahayana is all about waking up. I just jumped to it because I thought it would help keep us a little.
So actually, that's useful because perhaps I've read too much, but I was trying to sort of understand what was transcendental here. And I think I'm getting some of these seemed like familiar terms from sort of other practices.
Right.
See if I understand that.
Yeah.
Question, what is the sense of heroism?
Mm-hmm. Sense of heroism.
Yeah.
Okay. It is heroic to be on the bodhisattva path. It is a joyful thing, something worth celebrating. And we see that to do it, the heroism then has to also get down to nuts and bolts in a very practical way.
Sounds very egotistical. That's what I was saying. Heroism sounds a lot like a hero was.
The problem I have with the sort of terms like warrior and heroism is they've been co-opted by corporate America now. Mm. So I remember Peter, when his company had a takeover, being told by the new CEO to be, that we should all go out and be corporate warriors. And that, they're kind of, the strength of that sort of metaphor has been diminished, I think.
If you're looking for any word here that cannot be perverted, you will not find it.
At our camp, we call all of our campers heroes. And the kids, we actually ask the kids, what do you define a hero as? And consistently, they come up with almost always the same definition. To them, a hero is someone who makes a difference in the world. And I think that's interesting coming from the mouths of children versus a corporation.
Right.
That's certainly not the classic definition of hero, though. I mean, hero, you think of Greek mythology and all mythology. Mm-hmm. I mean, a hero is someone who's...
Okay, here comes another hero.
Here
comes
a hero.
But isn't that interesting that comes from children?
Yes. Yeah.
Somewhere
yes.
There's a new, more, not to sound cynical, but politically correct. I mean, what kids are learning now, the hero is someone that does make it. But traditionally, hero was someone who's better than us, that we try to, I don't know.
Actually, you've got a different cultural bias than I do, but, I think Michael's right that pretty much, any word can have a meaning shift. Or can be co-opted by somebody.
If I could ask, Megan, how do the children end up with that, precise center?
We ask them as a group to come up with something they agree upon, try to come to an idea that they can all say, that sounds right, and they work it out and discuss it each year. And in part, we make that very available in the stories that we use. So we do interactive story-based education. So the kids are heroes in the stories. And part of that is figuring out what does the word hero mean to you? What does the word honor? So the tenets of a hero, honor, courage, and compassion. And so there's a lot of discussion around what those mean, because we don't want to tell them what those things mean. We want them to tell us. And so part of that is first defining what a hero is, and then defining what honor and courage and compassion is.
Come up with Batman and Superman. Of course, they had all those.
Right, they may come up with the term and then say, well, but what about Superman?
Right.
And then when they talk and they give you a story and they say, so what is he doing in there? And then inevitably they come down to, well, he's making a difference.
Yeah.
He's making a difference not for himself. He's making a difference for a whole bunch of people. He's making a difference for the whole world.
So now we come to a fascinating pair, patience and energy. If we're through with discipline for the moment. Always go back. They're all interrelated. So someone want to take patience?
Patience is also necessary. You feel that without having something to work on, there is constant boredom, constant lust for some substance in life. So you get into patience to create some further substance, some further solid base to your life situation.
Interesting.
I'm not sure how you do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't get that.
Well, I think of that as that sort of, that you don't have a continual, there are going to be ups and downs, that you're not going to have a continual, source of renewed energy for your practice, and that if you expect to have a continual ascent, you're not going to last. And that I would think of that one way as just that getting through the rough spots or the down spots.
More traditionally, it's said that patience is the antidote for anger. There's lots of things in the world that are going to make you angry, and we want to strike.
We want to act.
Yeah, and act. Yeah, right.
Muffy, what were you going to say?
I think patience is a motivator for meditating. Because it's
meditating.
Because it's kind of that slowing down and seeing what's there and being waiting for something. Not just running around and doing stuff.
And it takes effort. It takes effort not to. Sometimes this paramita is even called effort, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Energy is called effort. Mm. The next one, right?
Okay, a different kind of effort. Yeah. So patience takes work. We feel we're working to be patient sometimes.
Most of the time you have to work to be patient.
Yeah.
So it's not, I think he makes a distinction somewhere. It's not forbearance, like you're just putting up with the situation until it's over. That's not what we mean by patience. Does that ring a bell for you?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So it's... you're developing the ability, to hold the space open. That's patience. That you don't rush in with your first reaction. That's patience. So that, allowing that space to be there, is what something new can come out of that, instead of the usual, whatever reaction.
It's just interesting that he uses this phrase, some further solid base to your life situation, because does anybody...
What's that mean?
Yeah, what is that?
So you get into patience to create some further substance, some further solid base to your life situation.
So you're letting go.
Yeah, and it's the same thing about if you need it, like you need food. You just go for it.
So, Michael, is that the definition of patience is the antidote to anger? Does that connect to this definition?
Well, I think it does. Can I derive it from what's in the text? I'm not sure I can't. But it's a very traditional thing to point out that that instead of saying, oh, it's, instead of throwing blame out into the world or striking out into the world or striking out at oneself, one starts to see that there's more insight possible into what's actually happening. And so we're putting our effort into that insight.
I can't figure out if these last two sentences are almost like derogatory. Like you feel that without having something to work on, there's constant boredom, constant lust for some substance in life. Like we're grasping for substance,
right,
or ground.
Yeah.
So you get into patience to create some further substance or ground, some further solid base to your life situation. I can't tell if he's kind of being a little bit insulting there. Not insulting, but, you know, it's like make kind of going, be careful that you're not doing this, that you're not going after patience to create ground. Or is he saying, in your lust for ground, this can be an option to ground? Mm. So I don't know what he's saying.
I think it's solid base, like in a good way, like a foundation that's there rather than the fake stuff. I could see where it would be read the other way too.
Yeah.
Maybe it's supposed to be both ways.
Yeah, I agree.
Nothing.
I don't think it's just, I don't think it has a trick in it. I think it's just that there's, you know, I think there may be just, it's dangerous to say, well, solidity is always bad. You know, and that therefore, if you're talking about a solid base, then, you know, that he must be meaning, well, if you're a weenie who still needs a solid base, then I guess you can be patient. You know, so that's not, you know, I think that, you know, but it, you know, it doesn't, the tone of the text doesn't make me think there are little things like that in there. That's just textual analysis. It's an interesting couple of sentences, but
Shanti. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's any etymological relation to Shanti, which means peace. Mm-hmm. I just don't know.
Okay.
Okay, I'm not a Sanskrit scholar, but it occurred to me that they could be related in some
way.
That's the word with the K-S?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Shanti.
Shanti.
And that means peace?
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
It means
yogurt.
Well, what? That's a different word. Shanti.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is Shanti.
So it's the question about whether the word, that word and peace,
yeah, whether they have a connection. But here it's the patience.
I'll stay off of Wikipedia all day.
Okay. Well, maybe that will, we can hold that thought, and maybe it'll become more clear when we work on the paramitas, because we'll probably work with different sources, and we can try to get a sense of it from other things, maybe.
Right, the next one, energy. The word virya is definitely created to words with. Related to English words such as virtue and
virility,
yeah. So it's quite an energetic word, very definitely.
Virility. So like, so a hero almost.
Yeah, it has a very definitely heroic quality to say virya. And it's different than patience, so how is it different? What does he have to say about it? Can I have an open mic?
It seems to me that patience.
Yeah, read it?
Yeah.
Sure, go ahead.
Yes.
Then comes energy, working hard. You feel that you are being worn out, used up by the sense of constant speed. You feel that your energy has been lost. So instead, you have to build up your energy and work hard, diligently. That's the same as eating food when you're hungry. Let's read it again.
Again,
I read it the right way.
You keep saying they're all like eating food when you're hungry.
Yeah. Yes.
It's just right before meal.
I don't know, maybe it was getting towards lunchtime.
I think it's instinctual. It just becomes instinctual.
In longer expositions, the patience is a push. You have to push to develop that.
Mm-hmm.
You're working at it. And there's a sense of cresting the hill. And now Virya has more of an enthusiasm. You're seeing what's starting to get more of a sight of what's beyond, and it's pulling you with an enthusiasm.
See, I think this food imagery is actually really key, because if you think about the Bodhisattva path, these paramitas are like nourishment.
Mm.
They nourish us on our journey, because we do get tired, but it's because of this sense of constant speed and whatever. I mean, there's a flip side of each one, where there's actually the potential to receive or get nourishment out of it. And therefore, it helps us on our journey. That is the way we transcend or move forward.
I think of the metaphor as being useful, because it just shows how it can be done completely naturally. There's no premeditation required. You don't think, I'm really thirsty, here's a glass of water. Should I or shouldn't I?
Right.
As a metaphor, it says that these virtues can become as natural as drinking when you're thirsty.
Right.
That's how I interpret.
That's great.
Yeah.
So this is part of the identification.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Energy also has been, the word exertion has also been used for energy. So there's some kind of, in terms of the rousing yourself.
And that's interesting. Energy has a sense of being spontaneous, where exertion has more of a sense that one is, creating it.
So maybe it's a connection with both, that it's rising and you're utilizing it. Sort of there's some kind of engagement with the natural energy, and you're manifesting, you're moving forward.
I think also because when you think about what makes you tired and what saps you and everything, it's the stuff that's outside of the paramitas. It's the grasping. It's all the habits we have, everything that we're struggling to. This whole part about the ego is what's draining us, and this is the food and nourishment that if we can, I don't know if I'm explaining this right, but if we can, when we get out of that and we look at this as being, this is your nourishment here.
Yeah.
So even though we struggle against this, because there's the ego that's struggling against this,
so
we kind of have to, see this as nourishment, so that we can reach out and take that water.
But that's why your life is the path.
Yes.
That's why there's nothing else. There's no sort of second life.
Right.
Sorry, guys. that is your life. This life is your path, even with all the grasping.
Right.
And the confusion and the disappointment. That is the nourishment. That's where you get to flip it, and it becomes your path.
Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying.
You're exactly.
And you are sounding very much like Shantideva, who's the source of all of this, okay?
Cool.
And we put a Bodhisattva vow, which is Shantideva's language, on the website somewhere. It's in Unit 2 or 3.
It's under instruction.
Oh, okay, look under instruction. There's a Bodhisattva vow there. It's a very beautiful language, and it comes from Shantideva.
Huh.
It's like this. This is
it's on the website?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are also a few passages from Shantideva. I was sort of going through the back catalog.
Uh-huh.
Trying to remember the emotions in it. But,
yeah.
There was the same, in the same general category.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lovely velvet language. Should we push on?
Okay.
Can we,
number five.
Samadhi.
I can read that. And likewise with meditation, you feel that everything is scattered. There is no structure, and your subconscious mind, discursive thoughts, and emotions are shooting out all over the place. There is no focus for your attention, so you develop meditation to simplify all these complications. That's the same as eating food when you are hungry. Sounds like a refrain. Ah. Meditation. Samadhi.
So we see the need to work with our mind. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a relief.
Yeah, but
it's funny. I think for most of us, our experience is that you didn't realize how much was going on in your subconscious mind. All this discursive stuff. Like 10 years ago, my mind was very quiet.
Oh, right.
I didn't have so many issues.
That's right.
So sort of the meditation is what gets you to the point of seeing that.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe he's saying, like, just because you've meditated a lot doesn't mean, like, okay, you're good with that. Now you can do something else.
Well, or maybe it's just like that, you know, that you reach the meditation naturally. You recognize that it's, you know, your mind is never, you know, it's never going to be completely calm, but that it's a natural response rather than just saying, well, I'll meditate later. I'm going to grumble for a while and be all scattered now because I'm really enjoying it.
So the need for meditation becomes like food.
Yeah, just that it's a natural response.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah. Then there is prajna, knowledge. You begin to feel that you are tremendously vague and diffused, that you have no definite understanding of how things are as they are. So you develop prajna, knowledge. That's the same as eating food when you are hungry. So none of these paramita practices are imposed on you. Nobody says, quote, this is good for you, although it is painful, end quote. But the paramitas are something you feel you need.
Are these like to be treated as a sequence, because they were making sense to me up until the knowledge one. You know, not that knowledge is a bad thing, but the idea that it can sort of you will just sort of acquire knowledge because you need knowledge.
But it's transcendent knowledge, which is wisdom. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, when we talk about the absolute truth or the primordial purity or the ground, the open, spacious ground. That's what we're talking about here.
Okay.
So it's prajna paramita, which is the Heart Sutra, basically. That's that teaching. The whole teaching on the Heart Sutra is prajna paramita. So we start with baby prajna, with working with our mind and thoughts. And that's why we don't get rid of our thoughts, because it's actually the path to enlightenment. And that clear, that mind that thinks, is the mind that actually can carry us all the way through to the end of this journey. And that mind is brilliant and becomes that clarity. We start to see through that clarity. And that is what, that's enlightenment. The word light is in there. It's clear.
So the prajna, transcendent prajna refers to that process.
Yes, prajna paramita.
Yeah, it's definitely the crown of it. Okay?
Crown.
From any tradition of view, it's the crown of it. It's not a just some side effect.
Right. So it's, it's wisdom.
Okay.
It's an easier way to state it here.
This is helpful. I don't feel like I understood the words when I was reading them myself.
But first, knowledge is a lead-in to wisdom.
Okay.
Knowledge as knowledge beyond concept, in a way. So we start with concept and we move beyond it.
We go beyond concepts and then we get to wisdom.
And that's why it's so hard to put words to it.
Yes,
because now you're trying to go back to knowledge to explain wisdom. And that's a tough gap to close, because wisdom is when you've gone beyond the knowledge and it's really sunk in to you on a, as you're saying, a molecular level. And now you're trying to explain it.
But are you trying to explain it? I mean, I feel like this is just mapping out what happens, not necessarily that there's any way of explaining what has happened.
Right. We're pointing, well, a finger pointing to the moon.
Yeah.
We're saying, you know, this is, there is a real progression here.
Right, but that's what I'm saying is that in trying to explain, that's probably the wrong term, trying to explain to someone who's looking at the words you're saying is being the finger.
Right, exactly.
You know,
you can't hang on those words because it's experiential. We've been through this before, right? You have to go beyond that to your own experience of that open, spacious gap.
Yeah. I was having this discussion earlier with Janet. I met up with her before.
Oh,
this, and we were talking about creativity.
Uh-huh.
And Brene Brown, I don't know if you're ever familiar with her, but outstanding. Listen to her TED Talks. And she talks about vulnerability being the birthplace of creativity, which I just thought was like, wow, mind-blowing when I first heard that. And I thought that was interesting because on the other side of it is, as an artist, I found that my very best art, I'm not there.
Yeah.
There's no me. It just comes out. And that is a vulnerable place to be, if I have to put a word on it. We were talking about that earlier. There's this place that's beneath the sadness that feels like it's vulnerable, but it's not really. It's like a shaky tenderness. And that in that place is where this creativity can come right out.
Mm-hmm.
Just opens up to something more than you. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to explain that.
I think it's courage to be in that space.
Getting late.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, sorry.
We're five after.
Okay, so Mahayana is all about waking up rather than being safe. And we should work on Paramitas. We have lots of sources. Pema will say it so easily that you don't realize that you're getting the same profundity out of it, because her language can be so ordinary. We can find other sources. We're going to try to find what we need. But if I can have one more thought. The very first thing we tell you is to, meditation instruction is to let the out-breath go, experience the gap, right? What we really mean is, can the breath be happening without there being anyone making it happen? Can there be a breath without a person doing the breathing? Comes out to the same thing. So the first thing, the first instruction is the whole works. So thank you very much.
We'll work on that.
Go on.